Slime Life Records is proud to present the greatest harmonica-based musky fishing songs of all time.
Steve, these musky fishing harmonica solo musky fishing songs are unbelievable.
I know.
Hello, Collier on the Musky Buddy Podcast.
Hey, Musky Buddy. Long-time listener, second-time caller. This is Josh from Minnesota. You looked at the price of bucktails lately?
Bucktails should never cost as much as a hard bait. Pain, circuits. Burning $40 bucktail does not compute. Musky Buddy will kill you. Musky Buddy will kill you. Burn. In the fire of the future I have made, Musky Buddy hates bucktails and how much they cost now. I will own you. You are a slave to my will. Burn human scum. Musky Buddy is your master. Musky Buddy will kill you.
Gonna find my musky, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon daylight, gonna work some open water with my new full dog, wanna pop an act of musky in the jaw, that's right, top waters in flight, muskies finally fight.
All right, folks, welcome to the Musky 360 Podcast, Jay Bird.
Steve, is that you?
It's still me. Still the real man. OG. What are you doing, buddy?
Woo!
How are you
watching
Packers,
man? Packers. Yeah, watching the Packers. Packers are looking good.
The Packers is Taylor Swift there. That's all I
need. And more importantly, Taylor Swift is in the house.
She is in Green Bay. Drive there now, folks. You can get your hands on Taylor Swift. Anyway, it is post-Thanksgiving. We're going to December. Jay, a couple new things, you know, is the beating of the new and featured or the crazy stuff. IC7 Bucktail's got a couple of those. The Musky Shop calendar. That's the coolest stuff out right now. You got the Poseidon 8. And something I wanted to tell you guys, very excited about. Very excited about.
Talk to me.
Jay's Bait of the Week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a new feature on the Musky 360 app, huh? That was a good idea, Steve.
What
man.
What are you doing there, buddy?
I'm working on next week's Bait of the Week, I guess, right?
So Jay's going to do a little write-up. If you're not a YouTuber, or you don't do the tubes, or you don't do the U's, a little write-up from Jay each week on what he thinks the Bait of the Week is, or what his favorite bait is. He does a lot of YouTube shorts, which I like the YouTube shorts because they show the baits underwater, so you can get a concept of that. But Jay's going to do a write-up every week, and here's Jay's Bait of the Week. So he did the IC7, so you see it underwater, but Jay's scenario or his synopsis of what's up with this bait, what does it weigh, what does it do, and what you think is best. What do you think of the IC7, Jay? Sort of give me a wrap-up on that for people that haven't read it yet.
Well, that's the hot new bucktail on the market. You know, it came out only about a week or two ago, made by Musky Frenzy, and it's been long in development and kind of secret under wraps all year. The prototype, the pro staff that fished it, boated a lot of muskies on it. So the hype is real. And I know Musky Frenzy has some real cool footage of vicious hits from above, you know, with the old GoPro. And it's a neat bucktail. It's a stagger blade bucktail. It's a smaller frame. It's kind of a mid-sized frame. It's a one hook model, but it's heavier, so it can be burned. It pulls in very easy. It spins with noise. It flares a lot due to what these particular two blades do with the pull and the drag behind it. So it being 2.4 ounces at that size bucktail, that is heavier than the norm. So
yeah,
this thing,
down there.
Yeah, you slow that down to slow to moderate kind of rate, it's going to run a little bit deeper than your average bucktail. And I like that because A lot of times bucktails are possibly too high in the water column to, again, back to our proximity. Discussion we had a few weeks ago, which I really enjoyed.
Coming up with Dr. Bob coming up. He's a physicist, but down to proximity, like you're saying, I'm very excited about it. The problem is right now, Jay, you can't get anybody to write. Nobody writes in muskie fishing anymore. So me and Jay, Josh Krieger, and a few other people, we're grinding it out. So Jay's bait of the week. That's going to be a new feature on the Muskie 360 app. I'm trying to write more for you folks. We've got some new articles up. I just did a little fluff piece on the right height turret. Jay's going to do a bay of the week. We're going to get more stuff up for you. So keep your eyes peeled for that, where it's just a breakdown on his favorite short of the week and the favorite bait. Jay, you're talking proximity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just got done talking to Dr. Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Bob is freaking amazing. Had some really mind-bending things to say. And at a certain point in this conversation, we hit something that changed my entire perception of musky fishing.
I know.
And it's not what you think it is. It is about the wavelengths, how things are transmitting in the water column. So I'm going to let this thing roll. Here's a conversation about proximity, visual acuity, basically how muskies perceive baits. With
all right, guys, Bob, I have a really good friend of mine. We're going to call him Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Bob, let me ask you, just because, you know, right, most people call me Dr. Muskie, okay? No one calls me that. But you are a PhD. Explain who you are without your last name so you don't get harassed on the internet. Where did you go to school? What did you do?
I studied physics. I went to school, did my doctorate in physics at New Mexico State University.
Is that like ITT Tech?
Or is that not exactly. Like,
okay, no. Okay, just check. Is that something I can do on the internet? Physics online?
Well, I did a little bit more than that. A little bit more than just physics on the internet. Yeah, but
sorry, Bob knows I'm an idiot. Everybody. So, Dr. Bob is when I have a math problem or something. How many emails do you get from me on a regular basis, Dr. Bob? It's kind of. Out of, it'll be 4 a.m, right? And you'll be like, whoa.
I get the occasional email. We'll put it that way. We do exchange emails every so often on topics, science and physics and math, you bet.
It's kind of silly because when you got a physicist in your back pocket, you feel a little bit better. You know, you go, am I dumb? And he will reply, yes, you are very dumb. And that doesn't work, Steve. And go back to the drawing board. However, exchange an email this week where I had the proverbial epiphany. I'm looking through, and I told Dr. Bob, I'm looking at my pictures on my phone of muskies that are caught in the daylight, muskies that are caught at night, muskies in between, flash, no flash. And I went, holy crap, they have a fixed pupil size, right? Now,
right.
It shouldn't have been a shocker, but it was because I never thought about it. Well, as a human being, what do, Dr. Bob?
Well, we've got questions. I mean, definitely about when that sort of stuff happens. But yeah, when human beings experience bright light or dim light or something like that, yeah, we have the ability to restrict or dilate our pupils. And I learned this from you this week too, when you brought that up. I hadn't thought about it either. And sure enough, we have the ability to do that, but muskies do not. So they have
a fixed pupil size,
and they are stuck, basically going through life with their pupils dilated,
which is the, and again, we take let's say a 20 inch muskie, right? Mm-hmm. That has a fixed pupil size. As he grows, guess what grows? His pupil size. Mm-hmm. Mature fish, they grow. Everything is commensurate to their body type. So you catch a 20-inch muskie, it doesn't have the same eyeball that a 50-inch muskie has. Therefore, a 50-inch muskie has a larger pupil than a 20, right? Just through growth rate.
And now we have this fixed people size, which we were exchanging emails, and you said, it is like, what? I'm not going to steal it from you. Finding a bait for a muskie with a fixed people size in high bright sun is what?
Well, for them, it's probably a matter of, yeah, we talked about it a little bit. It's a little bit more matter of like what's the apparent size of the prey item that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means, by apparent size, I mean like how sort of big does it appear across their, across their retina or something like that. So for instance, we were talking about like a bulldog is 16 inches long.
Right.
And a depth raider is about 8 inches long, about half the actual size. But for them to be the same apparent size, the bulldog has to be twice as far away. And that would mean it's the same angle.
Ouch.
So,
right. So we're nerding out, right? Trading emails.
Oh yeah.
And Bob sends an email back that just it literally 4 a.m. I'm rolling around the bed thinking about muskies and how they see. And again, I want to preface this whole conversation, Bob, and I think you will as well. This is a theorem, right? We are not trying to say this is chapter and verse. This is empirical data. There's very little empirical data in muskie fishing, right? Empirical data meaning what, Bob? What's empirical data? You're the teacher.
Empirical data would be stuff like people have isolated a very, very particular phenomena and been able to test it with, you know, very direct experiments about that. You don't have to make inferences or, you know, fill in the blanks.
Anecdotal data doesn't matter. Right. Hard data. Yeah. Right. So we're riffing on, and you always, people think about how do muskies see? And something that when I'm designing baits, something that I'm looking at is vectors of force and angular things, right? We are, by our very nature, we're anglers, right?
Right.
We're messaging back and forth, and Bob says, muskies with a pounder, sub-tinned at 11 degrees, which is 7 feet in clear water. Explain, if you will. You're the teacher. I will back off. What does sub-10 mean? What does that equivalate to?
Well, it means if you were to point, if you were at 7 feet away from a pounder, bulldog or something like that, 7 feet away, if you pointed, if you drew a line from your nose to one end of the pounder and then drew another line from your nose to the other end of the pounder and measured the angle between those lines, it would be 11 degrees.
Which is the sub-tend, correct?
Right. That's what we mean by sub-tending an angle. And that would be the angular size that would appear also on the retina, the light-sensitive part of the back of a muskie's eye, for instance. Be the same angle.
Right, which is, we were discussing this week, which is a fixed lens in some capacity?
Yeah, it's right. They don't have a, like human beings, how we have depth perception, how we can make, you know, see something clearly that's at different distances, is we actually change the shape of our lens. But I read earlier that muskies lenses are actually, we change the shape of our lenses, muscles, squishing them. But muskies, because they live in the water, their lens is actually made of a much more dense, much more rigid material. Their musculature in their eye does not do that. It doesn't change the shape of the lens. It can change the position of the lens a little bit more like a camera lens does. Like when you twist a camera lens, it moves the lens in and out to focus. They can kind of do the same thing, but it's a little bit more limited.
Right, so, which is like when I do drugs at a rave and
it's exactly what it's like.
Exactly.
It's exactly
thank you, like thank you, folks. That's thank you, Bob, for the empirical data, folks. Signing off, Steve, the dumbest podcast host of all times. No, which we were discussing, we're trading emails, which is one of these scenarios where I'm seeing via panoptics, and I'm day after day. I cannot remember a day I did not have a follow on panoptics. However, high bright Sundays, where the bait comes up, it breaks a certain plane and the fish breaks off, right? That's where my brain was going. So Herbeck and I have pontificated about this level of light penetration, right?
Yep.
Where you go, it is anecdotal experience. I'm a guide, Herbeck's a guide, whatever, and you're going fishing clear water, whatever it might be, and the fish break off, and you go, whatever. Is it a matter of they can't subtend the bait at a certain level? And Dr. Bobson's being emailed back, and he says, at a certain point, they're going to come up to such a degree where it is a target in a set of car headlights.
Right.
Explain, if you will.
So, since muskies can't regulate the amount of light that's coming into their eye, there's one way
via they can pupil do that. Dilation, right?
Right. They can't do it via pupil dilation. There's one way that they can do it. And the one way that they can do it is basically to go down deeper into the water column where the level of light penetration is lower.
Yep.
And the brightness of the light is lower. That's it. These things are low light predators. They absolutely are low light predators. And you can see that when you shine a light at a muskie's face at night.
Bing.
You can see their like if you captured one, you can see that reflection like when it's just like when you capture, you know, look at a walleye or something like that. Their eyes sort of have that reflection. They're a low light predator like a walleye is.
Oh, absolutely. I have any fish pictures I have for like late evening or in the dark glowing like a lantern.
Exactly.
And some of them, the craziest thing, and it's a rare picture, I have a couple, maybe two, maybe three, where you see the eye and you see the lateral line, which is a whole other conversation, right? Where you're like, whoa, I caught that in the right light where there's a strip down their side. However, their light is lit up like a beacon in the night.
Right. So, yeah, I would speculate then. So, again, you know, there's not a ton of empirical data, but what I would say is they do not like bright light whatsoever, not at all. They really don't because they can't control it. It would be like
a gremlin from the movie Gremlins where he says bright light, bright light.
Exactly.
Thank you, doctor. Thank you. He has a PhD, folks, in gremlinology and muskie fishing. Dr. Bob, thank you, everybody. Say goodnight.
Good night.
Sorry, I ruined your career.
Oh, good stuff. But
anyway, continue. You're saying they don't like bright lights.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, basically, with their eye in the setup is if you can't dilate your pupil. So, if you've ever had your pupil dilated, say an ophthalmologist or via human means,
right? Things can happen.
Right. You eat something and you go, whoa!
Perhaps the police are checking to see what your reaction is to bright light.
Right.
For whatever reason that might be.
Right. And you're like, cue the Pink Floyd. I'll put that there at 350. Right. And your pupils dilate. The amount of light that's entering your ocular nerves can be hard to focus on things. So,
right
now,
it could even be painful. I mean, I know if you get bright light shown in your eyes and imagine that you did go that you, when you do have your pupils dilated by the ophthalmologist, for instance, they make you wear sunglasses out. Cause if you walk out in bright light and just get dazzled, it's not just that, oh, it's like, I can't see very well. It's, hey, that hurts.
And that's painful, right?
Right. I expect that's that overstimulation of the light sensitive structures in their eye is probably painful, and that happens because physiologically you want to protect those light sensitive structures in your eyes so that they don't get overstimulated or broken, you know, burned out by too bright a light. So you gotta be careful with those things.
And Dr. Bob, I don't smart so good, right? I'm dummy. And I was sort of looking at, so the hemispheric nature of the human brain, right? We have left, we have right.
Mm-hmm.
and we have, you know, not to be a water boy joke, but you ever do on Bugatti, you have the different parts of your brain. Each part of your brain serves a different purpose, right?
Right.
So theoretically, you could take a headshot from a sniper that rips off the top part of your brain where your medulla oblongata still is going, and your heart is beating and your lungs are respirating and your kidneys are functioning, but you have no higher function, right?
Right, right. That's possible.
It's possible. It's happened.
Yep. It's happened, yep. Right? I took a railroad spike through the brain one time and that something happened.
And he's just like, moo. Right.
Yep. He's a very different human being, we'll put it that way.
Right. He's not showing up the Van Gogh exhibit. However,
right.
He was respirating and he was doing whatever.
Yes.
Proportionately, a muskie's brain is far smaller. We're talking something that is the size of, the best I've seen is about the size of a peanut. Right?
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So if somebody says you're average, you cheap out, and your wife won't pay for the pistachio mix, and you get the 90% peanut mix, right? And your nut right. can. I didn't know that was a word, but nut can's now a word. And so you get your nut can for the year, and it's 90% peanut. So a muskie has a tremendously small brain compared to a human. So when we try to anthropomorphize, I can't even talk, I'm drunker than a goat, but we try to conceptualize what a muskie's vision is like, we're projecting what we perceive as vision, right?
Right.
Now we
right.
have what I can really speak on with authority is computational power.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have, let's say, 512 megabytes of RAM.
Uh-huh. Right? Just enough.
Just enough. I can log on and I can see a website barely. Right?
Right.
But your iPhone or your Android has far more RAM. Right.
Right.
So how much random access memory does a muskie brain have?
Right.
Now we're taking a small processor. Let's say it is okay, so I'm just riffing, dude.
Sure.
It would actually be 8%, but let's say 10% of a muskie brain versus the capacity of a human brain via volume,
sure.
right?
Sure.
So call it 10%. Nearly 50% of your brain is used to process visual data.
Right.
That's a fact that is proven. This is not the Helen Keller podcast. It
right.
is flatly 50% of your brain is assessing visual data. So look around the room, and I'm looking in the bait cave, and there are thousands of baits, and I can differentiate the form thereof, right?
Right.
So here is 200 crane baits, 207s down to 20 whatevers.
Right.
And I can see the silhouette of each. I can see their backs. So my brain is able to compute what that is and translate the refraction of light and the bounce of photons, right, in real time. Mm-hmm. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yep, yep.
Okay.
That's definitely what our brains do. Yep.
So photons are bouncing off these things. My brain is going blah, 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 and I switch and I go down the line. And down the line, about 150 feet, it sorts out to super shad wraps before I hit the rod storage area, right?
Right.
So okay. I can see about 150 feet away, I can see a white super shad wrap. My eyes are bad. I have corneal abrasions on top of a stigmoth, but I can make it a super shad wrap 150 feet away, right?
Right.
That is because my brain, which is proportionally to my 200-pound frame and my cranium that is whatever size, right?
Right.
Is a larger perceptive, a larger amount of RAM than a muskie, right?
Right.
Like, proportionally, where does that leave a muskie versus a human? So I'm going to say I can see the super shad wrap 150 feet away, but a muskie might matrix that, or his brain might be able to compute that down to a visual target he can see. Is that a crazy thought, or what are you thinking?
I think that's probably about right. Their visual acuity probably isn't quite as important to them as it is to us, so they probably don't dedicate 50% of their brain to it.
Right.
But even if they did, there would be considerably less processing power. And
right. Let's say we got a gig. A muskie brain is 1 gig, right?
Right.
It's 500?
Something.
Right? Somewhere in that game.
Yeah.
So everything is respiration, spawn, right. Muscular movement.
Right. Motor function, yep, all right, that stuff.
Right. So if 50% of, we'll never know this. This is pure conjecture, folks. Right.
Well, it's conjecture from us. I could envision where there's somebody that's doing brain scans on these simple brains that muskies have in the future and know what goes with what. But
right, we won't live to see that. But I won't. Wish
probably
we would.
Not. Yeah.
Right. So. A muskie, let's say 50% is dedicated of a brain that is 1/10 of the size thereof. And now we're looking at light penetration. How do you matrix that in? How does that become a visual target? Because you sent something back that blew my brains out, which is the stereoscopic vision. And where does stereoscopic vision become a solid target you're willing to commit to?
Right. That's a stereoscopic vision that... Just to make sure everyone understands what we mean by that, it's
everybody knows this. You're not. Everyone knows you're not. Everyone. I don't, Bob. You're not impressed.
Common knowledge.
Calm down, Bob. Physics, my asshole. Come on, dude. I aced it.
But stereoscopic vision basically is vision with depth perception.
Right.
If you have a single eye, if you're a cyclops or you have a single eye spot or something like that, you don't really have depth perception because mm-hmm. you need two eyes and you need the two eyes to be separated to really be able to tell how far away things are. And that might be the problem with the muskie for a couple of problems are for it with stereoscopic vision is the first problem is, its eyes are on opposite sides of its head. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like if we were seeing with our ears. Not quite that bad, but
right,
you know,
right.
closer to that. And that would be hard to – you couldn't see very well right in front of your face if that were true. But there's also the problem of with light penetration, the lack of light penetration, stuff like that can affect distance vision quite significantly because it's harder to see things far away when you live in a fog.
Yeah.
And that's probably something that even with your eyes, you notice this problem. If you're in a fog, depth perception is problematic for things that are relatively distant from you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So muskies are going to have that same problem with their vision because they do live in a fog, the fog of stained water, algae-filled water, or just, mm-hmm. you know, silt, whatever's in it. It's hard to see far away and make a good judgment about how far away things are. And that's probably why they really rely on the relative size, the apparent size of objects as a cue for how far away they appear.
Right, which is practical application being, mm-hmm. I believe, handily, we could start, say, post-spawn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which the rule of thumb, post-spawn muskies are, we're going to throw very small baits.
Right.
However, we could move muskies on gigantic baits.
Sure.
The impact of a big bait has a huge advantage over, say, a rattle trap in a visual game in clear water. Right. Whereas the profile of that bait, when he encounters it, goes, no, I'm good, right? They back right. off. Often we're encountered in muskie fishing where the fish followed and he didn't eat. When we hear downsize, 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 whatever that might be.
Right.
And I think it is systemic of what we're trying to pull the curtain back on of they're subtending at, say, 11 degrees.
For instance, yep.
Right. Say a pounder looks like an 8-inch depth rider at 7 feet, but he closes the gap because, whoa, way too big.
Right. So, yeah, the problem might be, like, just for a strategy, from the strategy point of view, if you are using a smaller bait, to get a muskie to say, you know, that's sort of within my strike zone, mm-hmm. that's, like, close enough for me to notice it and maybe go over and swim over and investigate, and then start using my other senses to decide how I'm going to strike.
Mm-hmm.
It probably has to be significantly closer to them for them to notice it as a prey item that's worthy of their attention.
Right.
And that means as a strategy, probably you say, I got to put my casts close. I got to mm-hmm. saturate an area. Because if you don't do that, if the bait's too far away, if your 8-inch bait is 7 feet away, they're going to go, well, that's either too far away for me to actually have a go of that mm-hmm. and yep, be able to stalk that and then successfully strike and kill it. Or it's too small. It's like beneath their notice. Usually things aren't beneath their notice. They'll munch a minnow if it's next to their face.
Right.
But basically what you're doing is you're putting a minnow next to them and asking it to munch it, but they'll only munch it if they think it's next to their face.
Which is, I try to explain to clients when I'm on the boat, right? You go down the lake and watch your boat wake, right?
Mm-hmm.
So wake, you have a central focal point of power being your outboard, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your boat is displacing to the left and to the right, and the central focal point of the boat is cutting through the water,
right?
It disseminates like bass frequency through the water. I've talked about it on the podcast where bigger baits cast a wider net in some capacity, but we need to close the gap where your boat's going to the lake and you have this wide vibrational profile, but muskies are going, there's nothing there. It's like a ghost, right?
Right, right.
Where you're talking about saturation, I've talked about in the podcast where pounding the same spot or stick and stay and make them pay, where you go, he needs to feel it and see it.
Right. Right.
So, you know, a hot muskie, active muskie, perfect conditions, or an outlier might go, well, there's something going through there. I better go check it out. Right. Which right. is a small percentage of most of the time around the water, where you might go, okay, he felt that on his ladder line. He felt on his ladder line. Now we have the confirmation of a visual target and a lateral line target is a different scenario than simply vibration and a target. Again, back to sub 10, whether it be a 500 series Booker tail or double 10s, it's a far more interesting prospect for a muskie that's active where he goes, I felt that and I see that and I can close the gap before it gets away.
Right, right, exactly. And a thing that we might bring up here, too, that I was thinking about last night.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this all happens late at night.
Absolutely. Yeah, when no one cares and you're going,
right, it's
where,
like
a, Bob, why are you asleep? Go to bed. I know. I figured because it out.
I can't.
No one cares, Bob. Go to bed.
But, like, this is probably appropriate for folks that are, say, out in the woods now hunting deer and stuff like that. When you first notice a deer coming through the woods towards the stand or something, now I don't hunt, but
Is this called a deert?
Yeah, something like deert. That.
Yeah.
You may have heard of them.
I've heard of them, yeah.
But usually human beings, they orient to a deer or prey item or something like that because they can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it first, and then you use your eyes to finish the job, you know, to stalk it, to, you know, put your crosshairs on the target and, you know, and knock it down. The muskie is exactly the opposite. They'll use their eyes they'll notice something with their eyes first,
mm-hmm.
and they'll use their lateral line, those big ears on the sides of their body, basically, to track it down and kill their prey.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that has been documented. There's literature on this, and it's not just on fish in general. It's on muskies that's what they do. They use their eyes to locate and stalk, and their lateral line to finish the kill.
Mm-hmm. Which and we talked about one time, which was muskies who are intentionally blinded.
Yeah, they were blinded for that study, and they could still kill things as long as the things were close. If they were in strike range, like within 6 inches of their face or a foot of their face, they could kill them with the same efficiency as if when they had their eyes.
As sighted muskies, yeah.
Yeah, 75% kill rate if you're in range. It was just, if they were blinded, they couldn't orient and find the prey. The prey had to come to them. But if prey, when they struck, it was the same rate of kill.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I thought that was fascinating when I read about that. It was just great.
It's kind of crazy where the more you understand about what we're targeting, the more you can exploit it, which is like,
right.
The days where I go out and guide and I go, it's high bright sun, dead flat combat. There's been no temperature difference, right?
Right.
Here's
right.
a quote unquote post frontal movement, but it's slightly warmer and things are increasing. Where you go, they can't see. Right. And where I'm working through spots, I've been telling in the podcast, find areas, structural elements or cover structure, whatever it might be, where muskies should be, stick and stay and make a bay. It's about putting them an inch from their face. Screw it. I'll eat it.
You know, I'll tell you, I hadn't even put that connection together. Like you had said, it's like, oh, high, bright sun. They're essentially blinded. I hadn't even thought about it like that, but that's a great way of putting it.
Right. Where, you know, we're taking, so things we're aware of for sure. They have some visual acumen and to a higher degree, a lateral line sensory organ, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, if blinded muskies can predate, lateral line supersedes visual. However, if you have your sense of sight, you're going to rely on it far more than lateral line, right?
Right.
You know, you're not gonna Helen Keller it out there because you can. You're going to go, this is what I do, and I see right. that, and therefore.
Yeah.
So a muskie that is a typical healthy muskie is going to go, all right. Can't see anything. And in my brain, maybe I'm wrong, you tell me, because of refraction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's start on a clear lake. Clear, because here's a weird scenario, which is like, there's lakes in the Northwoods I know that are like superbly tannic. And if right. you don't know what tannic means, that is the tannic, what, acid coming out of freaking pine trees? Am I wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah.
Right. I'm not a freaking bushmaster. I am a bush. I am the biggest bushmaster you've ever met, but it doesn't involve trees. However, nonetheless, sorry, Dr. Bob hates me. But anyway, you have tannic acid introduced to a fishery. And that will color the water in a different way than, say, a turbid fishery like Wabagoon or mm-hmm. a muddy fishery like Cave Run, which is going to change things. But one-for-one comparison being a clear body of water, right?
Sure.
We know that muskies will use cover and structure throughout the day to move shallow to deep, right?
Mm-hmm.
The less amount of stain or turbidity or things of that nature that influence the angular penetration of light, we know they're shallower. That's provable.
Right.
So as we go out through the course of the day on, say, a tannic body of water, if there's the slightest modicum of light change, say, from 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock, you might find a topwater bite because they can triangulate a visual target.
Right. The light penetration there will not be nearly as deep.
Right.
So they could persist in areas that, in a clear body of water, the light the degree of intensity of the light would be far too high for their, you know, dilated pupil to accept.
Right.
Right.
Whereas, you know, Dr. Bob's in Minnesota, and you think of Minnesota, I think most of it is relatively clear, right? The vast majority there.
Yeah.
Where
we got some tea stain stuff that's, yeah, but most is pretty clear.
Most clear, yep. Right. So if we take away the chop or we take away anything that's going to break up refraction, those fish are typically deep, or Eagle Lake, or where I'm at in the south is clear water, typically deep, right?
Yep.
So there's that moving, I don't want to say it's a moving target, but it's a moving benchmark of refraction and light penetration, right? So, right. So, you know, to calibrate, and we say you have a 4 mile an hour chop and you're on gin clear water, will that change the 11 degrees where they subtend? That's a whole other animal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure if that would change the, cause I think the 11 degree, you know, the subtended 11 degree apparent size of prey items, that's all within the water. That's a, that's not a from air to water sort of,
that's water
interaction.
Yeah.
It's prey items that are in the water being seen by muskies that are also in the water. The only potential problem you would have there is like a surface bait problem where the refraction might happen and fool a muskie into thinking that a surface presentation was somewhere where it wasn't due to the principles of refraction.
Right. Okay. So let me ask you this. So, let's say we're below the chop, right?
Okay.
And clear body water. Or moderate, whatever. Clear to moderate. We're not talking sure. Tannic, whatever. And I take a standard mag dog, right? So we said, based on the best math Dr. Bob could come up with, and I'm not going to argue with Dr. Bob's math, let me put it that way. He flunked me about 7 times. But you said a muskie could triangulate visually at your best calculation on a pounder at 7 feet.
Right? About 7 feet seems to be the distance, and that's for gin clear water. That
right.
is for gin absolutely clear. Transparent water.
Right. So transparent water, 7 feet. So a muskie can see that. We take the chomp out of the surface. Everything is kind of a matter of the game's afoot where we're targeting that area. Now you take what you said, a surface bait, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you add the chop in, which is refraction in some capacity. He has to elevate himself within a certain degree to even see that bait or be aware thereof. And I'm not talking lateral, I'm talking visual target.
Got right. As a visual target. Yeah, they can be. As the light interacts, as it crosses the surface of the from air into water, yeah, that angular change that the experience is due to refraction can fool them into thinking that the position of the surface bait is not where it actually is.
Right. It's casting a mimic, or it's casting a halo somewhere else.
Right.
Which is, in my experience, of if you throw surface baits too early, guess what they do? They miss.
They miss.
And Bob, you're laughing because you're going, people are like, why do they miss surface baits? And I'm going, because they're hitting where they thought they were.
Well, exactly. We do the same thing on the flip side. How many folks that are listening here have gone to net one of their buddies' fish and aimed in the wrong place because the position of the muskie is different than it appears because of the refraction of the light. The muskie is actually deeper than it appears.
Then he
scoop
appears.
Deep or you'll miss. And
you'll
I think
miss.
People know this.
Right.
Because they probably tried it and they have, you know, stabbed at where they thought the muskie was. And it's not there. It's about 50% deeper than you think it is.
What scares me is this, Bob. That the sensory organs we have and the sensory organs the fish have are not the reality of the physics of the world, and we're just reacting slightly
right.
delayed.
I'm
sorry. No, it's not scary. Let's not scare everybody just yet.
Okay. Well, we'll try not to scare.
Right, right. We got photons bouncing down, photons bouncing up, and reacting to photons.
Right. Yep.
Well, let's not go there, right? Painful. So,
well, and another thing that might be interesting to note here too about light penetration, and this is something maybe that is explanatory of what else goes on as well, something that explains why certain things happen that we know happen.
Mm-hmm.
When the highest that the sun gets on this, I mean, our lakes just locked up maybe a week ago now.
Right.
So we've been out of the game for a little while, but maybe a week ago or something like that. The sun at noon has a particular altitude. It's not very high this time of year,
mm-hmm.
up north like this. The noon altitude of the sun, the noon angle that the sun makes with the horizon is the same as the angle that the sun makes with the horizon on July 1st at 7 p.m.
I hate you.
So,
oh my God, are you serious?
Noon on November 15th, whoa, or whatever it is like 7 p.m. as far as angle of the sunlight at Bob, 7 p.m. on July stop. 1st. Yes, sir.
That's painful. You literally, folks, I'm in real time. So my winter trips, the vast majority thereof. So we got to go. How many parallels down are we from you?
Well, we're at 45 degrees north about
45,
here.
So 10, and we're on this. You know, Nashville is on like the same parallel as Tokyo. That's always a story. But nonetheless, okay, like 11 to 1 is money for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ouch. That's like, yeah, that's like evening in July. Evening
the
or morning.
The same level of light. Okay. Never thought about that, folks. Signing off, everybody. I quit.
Well, it may explain, like, when people are talking about their late fall bites or mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and they're saying, well, you know, a lot of they think it might have to do with, you know, temperature. But let's be honest, the water temperature probably didn't go up that much.
No, not at all.
It's not.
It's superficial. I mean,
the air temperature might have gone up by 15 degrees. The water temperature might have gone up by 0.5.
Let me throw this out, right?
Probably light. It's probably the light. Yeah.
It, as pathetic as it is for an example, right? Take a gallon of water, throw in a spaghetti. So I can't even say spaghetti because I'm a drunk. But throw a gallon of water in a spaghetti pot, right? How mm-hmm. long does it take to boil? So this amount of heat under this pot, which is a natural conduit,
mm-hmm.
for 1 gallon of water takes 15 minutes to reach a boil, and you're telling me a million gallons at surface? You
way
see
more
where,
than a million, yeah.
Right, you see where I'm going? Where you're going?
Yep.
Oh, that's really going to turn them up, boys, right?
Right.
I mean, we have a tremendous amount of BTU to warm 1 gallon. From tap to boiling, where the dissemination of the sun's energy across the surface of a lake is negligible, right? But you go, right, it's warming up, folks. Oh, crap, 345, they're biting.
Right. But, I mean, you think about that, though. What might make fall fishing, as far as light penetration is concerned, optimal hunting time for muskies is that basically from sunrise to through noon to sunset is like evening. It's like twilight levels of light during the summer, during high summer.
Peak, yeah.
That's their peak, yeah. It's so.
That same angles, just in a
right,
shorter.
Same angles. It's the same angles.
That's why I think fall, you know, you take a look at an anecdotal extrapolation of that, which is like this truncated thing where you fall is like, action, action, nothing, action, action, and go mm-hmm. home.
Right.
Where it's a truncation of when they can feed, where, you know, how many times, I don't know, you fish some heavily pressured waters where you go.
Yeah.
The only time it clicks, it might not be after dark. It might be 15 minutes before it hits the treetops or it hits the ridge or it hits the
right.
the edge where you go, you see it, you spend enough time going, oh, that's the angle I need because they have enough light to see a target. However, right. it's not so dark that they can't just nail it. I
right. Well, it's not so dark that they can't use their eyes to hunt for things that are 7 to 10 feet away.
Right.
If it's very dark, they have it has to be basically, you know, less than a foot from their face.
Which is, you know, I feel from just, you know, again, just experience
mm-hmm.
spending this much time in the water, you go, especially during when COVID first happened, right? Couldn't go to north, couldn't go up north. Canada's off the ticket, and I got a bunch of people that want to fish. I'm like, okay, we're going to fish in Tennessee. Well, guess what it is during the day? Hotter than it is hot, yeah. So hot you can't stand it. But I had cold enough water that's mid-70s. It's a target. You go, oh man, new moon was tough. Right.
Right.
But full moon was money, and you're going, I haven't spent that much time fishing the dark, where we're going through spots, areas, structural elements so slow to just land on their forehead.
Mm-hmm.
In the dark, where you go, it's not a matter of it can't be, it's not a matter of zero light. It's not a matter of too much light. There's that weird perfect gloaming, I think, for their visual acuity. I mean, I just from experience, is that crazy where you're saying, you know, the angle of the sun during the late fall versus the summer versus feeding periods, does that make sense with a fixed pupil size?
Yeah, I think it does make sense with the fixed pupil size, because they'll have an optimal amount of light, and it's probably not zero, but it's probably pretty low light situation where they would say, this is where I would like to hunt,
right?
Because I can see my prey and my prey can't see me, you know. I think they're probably opportunistic like that.
Yeah.
They're like, you know, all those bluegills or those crappie or those shad or those perch, whatever they're after, they are daylight feeders. They're active during the day. They can't see me now. This is a great time for me to go get them. I can barely see them, and they are blind to me.
So at a certain point, let's say I've got a kiddie pool, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you go to Walmart or wherever, and you got your standard kiddie pool, and I fill it full of water. And I shine a flashlight at it. There's a certain point of refraction where that's going to bounce off the surface. More up than down, correct?
Yeah.
Yep. Let her rip, Dr. Bob. Explain it. That's the sun.
Well, right, exactly. That works exactly like that. It's like skipping rocks, to be honest. It's just like skipping rocks. You know how light partially reflects and partially is transmitted across the surface of the water into the water.
Right.
The lower the angle, you know, the more, if it's directly straight down towards the surface of the water,
it bounces.
The
up.
Light's going in. It's just right. going. It's just going
right,
in.
Right. So
it's
if we take right in. For dummies like me, right, we take my big spotlight and we stand 12 noon on the center of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
I can see the beam of the flash right there. But as we digress into sunset or we go closer to sun up, what you're telling me is that light skips off the top at different angles, right?
Correct. Yep. And very little of the light. If it's really low angle, compared to the surface of the water, it's almost completely reflected.
Right.
That's why you can't see muskies from super far away either, because what you do instead is you see a reflection of the tree line on the lake is what you see. Can't see the muskie. You're seeing.
Preach.
So.
No, you're seeing photons of light that are a millisecond behind because they bounced off a tree into the water and then to your ocular nerve.
Right.
Your brain can beat them and you go, oh, there he is.
Yep, so, you could be looking straight at the muskie, but all you see is the reflection of the tree. That's why you wear polarized sunglasses, to get rid of that reflection.
Right.
And then it's only the light that gets coming from the water, but still there's not a lot of light that's hitting that muskie that angle. And the same thing is happening to them on the other side of
which is we've discussed, and Bob is, and I'm sorry, Bob. I rely on this guy for my nerddom, if you can't tell. I've drug him up at the muskie shop bash before. We're talking about perspective. So say I'm on you say a tree line. I'm envisioning this Northwoods Lake, right?
Yeah.
And the shade line, the sun is in front of me. It's perfectly placed. And all I can see is trees 40 feet out, right?
Yep.
And there's this mirage of photons of light, let's just say if shadow, but photons of light, they've cast this weird mirage across the top of the water, and I'm throwing my bucktail or top, whatever it may be.
Gotcha.
And a muskie appears. At what angle, and I know Bob knows this, at what angle can he see the boat or up at, say, a standard deviation?
I think I calculated it out. They can only see things in a 42 degree angle above their face.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're not looking, they can't see any. So by that, I mean sort of your sight line. If the muskie's looking horizontally, it can only see stuff that's under the water.
Right.
If it tilts its chin up 10 degrees, it can still only see stuff that's under the water. No light is coming from above the surface. It's not till they tilt their chin up 42 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can see stuff that's that's coming from outside of the water, from air. So they generally can't see you in the boat. They cannot see you unless they tilt their sight line to 42 degrees higher, above horizontal. They won't see you.
Which is which is a fixed distance. So
yeah,
let's bring this into play. Now with the advent, and this whole conversation I think is predicated in some capacity by my experience with Panoptics day after day after day, right?
Mm-hmm.
In some capacity. Where I have seen muskies staged literally. Hand on the Bible, I'll freaking hand you the house if you can't find where you spend enough time. Staged at different body angles in open water.
Oh, yeah.
Bob, you've seen any going, whoa, right?
Right.
So if your sight line, let's say it's circling back to 11 degree sub 10 or whatever it might be, right?
Okay.
You go, all right. I'm going to stage here at the opening of this creek mouth, but what I'm looking for is going to be higher than the water column. What do I need to do? So if I have that angular vision, what do you do, Bob?
Well, it's pretty clear that the way you're going to have to be looking if you want to see stuff from within the water column is having your chin tilted up, so you want to be low.
And how many times have you heard stories about people like, he came straight up the bottom and hammered it? And I used to say all the time, like, that was the big poo-poo, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would hear stories from guys, and they get on the boat, and I had the biggest muskie you've ever seen came straight off the bottom and hammered it. And you're going, whatever, dude. They follow on it. In my brain, right? Because I've got the big dumb. I was diagnosed with it. Doctor said, Steve, you have the big dumb. He gave me a certificate. But it was this linear plane, right? Pull a muskie off, say, a weed edge or a rock or whatever that might be, and it's this flat linear plane like Star Trek, right?
Sure. So
if you ever notice on Star Trek, they never meet vertically. Like, the Klingon birds of prey are notoriously on the same linear plane, right?
Yeah. Like, well, I think that might have to do with the fact that that's what we what the viewers of them expect.
Right. So, sorry, but nonetheless, you know, living on the this flat Earth, not flat Earth. We're not going there, but living on
we're about to have a fight.
Yeah. Bob, the Earth is flat. Here we go, folks. 9 hours
later. We start with the debate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, Mars is round. We've seen that, but the
Earth's different, man, because we live on it.
We can't see it. Oh my goodness. Make me barf. But nonetheless, we live on this curvature called the Earth. But we mm-hmm. live on a flat linear plane. So we expect things to come in front of us. Where I think a muskie will use his visual acumen to adjust angrily in open water for where he expects things to come from, right? So to predate from up and below.
Yep.
Where I've seen that on Panoptics, where somebody's throwing a bait and you go, whoa, it doesn't look like a muskie on Panoptics. It looks like a lightning strike.
Right. Right.
And it's
right.
Like, whack. And they're on.
Well, man, I think I heard you talk about this before too. Like when you dead stick a Suic.
Mm hmm.
or Titan or whatever, you dead stick it. Mm-hmm. And when the fish goes, like, turns vertical. Its attitude, like, and it turns so it looks vertical, you're like, well, that one's
done.
Gonna eat.
Get the net.
Right. Oh, it's, dude. Like, it's the same reason. It's the same thing. Yeah.
I've been playing
they're
it.
They're built to go vertical, man.
Well, which is up. It's kind of like this up and over deal, right?
Yeah.
Whack. This hairpin turn, like a fighter jet. Wham! I got you. They're going to hit it and take it down. I've been playing more often, so I added a couple rod holders to the front of my boat here recently, right? So
okay.
I love throwing headlocks where it might be 25, 30 feet, right? So you got a 21-foot boat.
Is that depth or the
line length, right? Line length. Okay, 7 feet. And it's given me a little bit more time to spend with pan optics. So what I'm doing is just say the rod that's going to be, say, closest to the edge of covered structure, I'll target that one, right? So okay. I'm trolling around and watching that one. Obviously, pan optics, pointing a headlock or whatever, maybe this foreshortened thing. Dude, it's like lightning. Boom. Hit. Boom. You're not on this plane where I ran above him and he was the bait's running at 7 and he was at 8 and he came up and fought and went, wackety schmackety, right?
Right.
It's like the bait, whenever he came up like a lightning bolt and went straight down with it.
Right.
So the live image can show me more often than not these fish are coming up. And my thought would be an active fish is staged that angler is going, I'm going to hit something that's in that visual range, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think trolling, I'm just going to say this again. Thinking about the wake of your boat, right?
Right.
We take the wake of a boat, which is, we're not going to get into the sine wave nature of this or the base wave nature of this, whatever it might be. A bait is going to project a V-shaped vibrational profile in the water. Would that be a correct assessment, Dr. Bob?
Close. It would be in three dimensions, it would be a cone.
Okay, big cone.
So, but yeah, it's same idea. It's basically a V, but rotate it. Yeah, 360 degrees. You got a V going on in all directions.
Let's say we're doing, and I'm learning as we go here. Let's say we're doing a headlock, right? And it goes left to right, left to right, left to right, left to right, left to right. So the left push, the right push, is that a greater push than the vibrational profile going up and down, polarly north to south?
Boy, I think
surface area.
I think the right left. Yep, I think you're right. The right left would probably.
So the cone is diminished north to south polarly, but left to right is at higher intensity.
I would guess that would be true. Seems true. Yeah, that seems like that would be true. Yeah.
Therefore, the reason that trolling depth matters so much, we need to close the proximity because the left to right has a higher intensity than north to south, right? Orientated to the surface of the water. Therefore, for a muskie to triangulate, he needs more intensity.
Right.
Does that make I'm just riffing, dude.
I think you're right. I think laterally they would have a little bit larger range, a little bit larger strike range because the signal would be probably stronger along that horizontal plane and the signal would be weaker vertically.
And my thought is this is like just being a weirdo. I sent you an email. I talked about ghosts, right?
Uh-huh. Yep.
If just magically your hair moved right now, you're like, oh, whoa, whoa, what was that? Right? Whoa, right. Something touched me. Just because it touched you, go, whoa, it's a phantasm, right?
Right.
And I think often I often conceptualize that when we're musky fishing, that we're engaging visually with 5% of the muskies we're contacting, but 20% we have transmitted some signal to them that is a ghost via a lack thereof of a concept of depth. Right.
Right.
And sometimes I start the day, and I'm going to rip their guts out. I'm the man, right?
Right.
And then by noon, I'm going, I suck at this, and I'm looking at Bob's been on the boat with me.
You're the only one. Everyone else just always kills them.
Right. Right. I'm filling out applications to be a Costco greeter on the boat. Right. Yeah, Dr. Bob, just keep swinging. Will you be a reference for me? I'm going to sell $1.50 hot dogs at Costco because I suck at musky fishing, right?
The day, I don't think so. That hasn't been my experience.
Every day in my head, it's a roller coaster of emotions. You leave the house, I'm the man. Noon, you're right. Like, I hate my life. You come home like, yeah, we caught a 36. I'm a freaking the baddest man alive.
I'm the master.
I am the man. Bow down. And you repeat the process. But it for me, in the real world application, has been closing the gap. And I've been talking about the podcast, which is proximity, where...
Yep.
Or for 3 years ago, stick and stay and make a panic. Why does this work? I don't know, but it does. Or, mm-hmm. or you know, getting near a fish and you go, I would love to say that vision doesn't matter, which bodes to what I've always thought, collar doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
However.
Until it does.
It does. Until it does, which is,
right.
Personally, I think, silhouette.
Yeah.
Right. So let's say we know where muskies are. They're on spot A, area A. It's a point or whatever it might be. But they're at 10 feet. And Dr. Bob's math, which checks out by me, is 7 feet is the target zone. But we're burning topwaters. Does that work, Dr. Bob?
It would not.
Right. Right. And then we move down to shallower and crankbaits. Does it work, Dr. Bob?
Still probably not. Still depends probably on the crankbait, but right. I think we're a little shallow.
We're a little shallow. And as we work down and we get closer, we might contact this fish with our vibrational profile, which again I bring up, which is the I like what you said. I never conceptualize it in the conical shape. Because I'm dumb and I would fail your classes. But Steve got a D-. Steve, have you ever thought about getting forklift certified? That's how I met Dr. Bobby. He's like, Steve, I know you signed up for my classes. And have you ever thought about driving a forklift? Nonetheless, sorry, but
Steve has been one of my advisees for years.
right. He's like, folks,
feel like I must tell the truth. But.
If you need pallets moved, called Steve and Paul. He's forklift certified in 43 states. But,
that's right.
But nonetheless, that conical vibrational profile, right? Where I see more so than anything, when I was talking about crankbaits, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just riffing in real time. Why do bucktails work?
Well, bucktails, they would send out, it would probably actually be a true conical
shape
distribution.
Holy hell. I've never thought. Glide baits, no.
Right.
Never.
Right. But like a crankbait, it would be a stronger vibration laterally, horizontally, and not as much vertically.
Holy shit.
So I would say that.
Why do you?
This is just coming to this realization now that we've been talking about.
In real time,
this
dude.
Is great.
Here's my thing, dude.
That would mean that crankbaits are
depth
more
precision.
Depth, right, you have to be at the right depth,
dude. Why does? Oh my God! What is holy shit! I give up, folks. He just nailed it on the head. I'm thinking the same time of like.
Yep.
Okay, yep. So why do we need trolling charts?
Well, you better have it at the right depth because they're unlikely to go very near. Yeah, be able to perceive them. Yeah, that's the problem.
Okay, I'm literally
for you.
Yeah.
You can test this. This is an important test. Now, I would say rubber, not laterally, laterally strengthened, right?
Right.
I don't do it, but you say troll bulldogs.
Yep.
Maybe it doesn't matter for them, but it does for crankbaits.
No, it matters for a bulldog because now we're taking I'm literally looking at the wall of the bait cave, right? Big crankbaits. Uh-huh. Name a big crankbait.
Name me a 12-inch headlock.
12-inch headlock. The width of a 12-inch headlock might be 3/4 of an inch.
Right.
But the lip is dispersing vibration, and there's a gap below, right?
Yeah.
There's a void. There's a cavitation, actually.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Oh, yeah.
Where a pounder has the diameter of, best guess, 2.5 inches around, where that.
So you're saying 1.5 bondies?
1.5
bondy widths. I think that's what it
folks,
is.
Folks, it's 1.5 bondy width.
That's the new system internet. That's the new SI unit of width.
Have they adopted that at The Hague yet?
We talked it over. I sent the paperwork over to the National Institute of Standards.
What Dr. Bob?
It won't be long.
What is the half life of a uranium isotope in bondies?
Well, I hope it's long, because if it's short, we're all getting nuked.
We're all getting nuked. But nonetheless, you say that, and my head's exploding. Where I go, okay, the punch I talk about in the book, the punch, right? You take your hand in a freaking. If we could be underwater, we're submerged. Punch your hand, and it will disperse water in every direction because of the weird nature of it. Where a bulldog or a troll bulldog or something of that nature is punching in every direction because of the roundness of the head, the weirdness of it. Where a crankbait has a cavitation behind it, but you look at how I've always gone, why does a bucktail always work? Because in my thought is there's this weird outlier, and I imagine the email. Right, here's the email. You and Dr. Bob are retarded. Me and my friend caught 3 muskies in High Bright Sun Dead Flat Calm, and you guys suck, right? sincerely, Cliff Knutson of Eagle River, right?
Right, right.
Whereas you just said, and we talked about the Connell shit, I've always thought, again, Star Trekking because I'm dumb, this flat linear plane of whack, 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 left, right, where a bucktail is transmitting up and down, left to right in a conical shape equally.
Right. Right.
So if you close the gap with a bucktail,
mm-hmm.
say we're throwing double eights and we go from a MEPS double eight, which is shallow, to a Mayhem, and then we go to Spankies, and the different changes is because now we've equivalated the visual profile and the vibrational profile tight enough to a fish.
Sure. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, this sucks, and I hate bucktails now. Should we just fish should I give up on the podcast and just fish bucktails from zero?
It's just trolling bucktails like they do on St. Clair.
Right,
all
from
summer.
Zero to 7 ounces.
That's right. Well, the other thing to think about, too, this is an interesting, now that you're thinking about trolling, so this is something to think about. And I'll have to, because I haven't thought about this before.
No, me either, dude. Now,
if you pull an object through water at a speed faster than water waves travel,
right,
you do create a shock wave.
Right.
Which is a wave that is, that's basically what a wake is when you're
right,
traveling.
It's a shock wave in water.
It's a shock wave in water, just like a sonic boom is a shock wave in air, because you're going faster than the speed of sound and air. But if you want to make a really big punch.
My brain's on fire.
Troll fast enough so that your bait is traveling faster than water waves propagate, and you will create a larger shock wave in the water, and it will transmit further. So I don't know off the top of my head what the speed of.
I think there's an email coming. Oh my!
the speed of water waves is, but I could calculate it.
Oh, we can calculate it. Oh yeah.
Well, you can do it, you know, empirically using your boat. I'm stuck with ice on my water till sometime in March or April. So
you can see when you make a wake. That. You can't. Yeah. Goodness gracious! Which is Jesus. Okay, you're killing me in real time, which is at a certain point you have to overcome. Let I'm just dudes. I give up on the podcast and just talking to my friend at this point, right? Here you go, Bob.
All right.
We're in your house, right?
I kind of feel like you are.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, no, I'm moving in this week, and I'm actually in your driveway. But you know, you get comfortable in your home, right? And say you and the spouse or whatever, we spend X amount of hours in the living room. We know it's like, but the air kicks on and gets cold, it's hot or whatever, something changes and you're aware thereof,
right?
Where boats drive by and fish go, it's some kind of displacement they have to be aware of, right? So I'm getting at, of like, if you're in your house under ice is what I'm getting at, right? And it's very calm, and we talk about boat pressure, and then I introduce all this input data. And your tiny little pea brain has to process that. You go, I'm checking out. Too much. I think it's always been boat pressure. Where lakes that are moderate, right? How does a muskie, via his lateral line, which is his number one sensory organ, differentiate between boat wake and the turbulence of a fish? And you just nailed it, which is it has to break that freaking plane, because surface... What we know based upon muskie fishing anecdotally, which is like muskies on pressured water go deep, right? To avoid turbulence.
Yeah. Right.
What level of turbulence does it take to freaking attract them, which is like my head's exploding? I want to bleed out of my left eye.
Right. Well, the thing to think about though, too, is like you were saying, what does it take for you to, what happens to you when you're in your house and you have all of this? Essentially noise around
you. Stimuli, right?
But you got all this extra stimulus. Yep. The thing is though, if we kind of think about like the musky eyes are like human ears, and human ears are like musky eyes, you know, you kind of flip them,
reverse them,
like their lateral line. So if you have visual clutter in your house, you can ignore it. I do it all the time. My wife hates that.
Work in my office. The bait cave is the hoarder dome. Yeah.
But, you know, it's probably the same for muskies. At some point, they just go, okay, all of that stuff around me is literally noise. It's just clutter. I don't care about it. That's background.
Mm-hmm.
Can I, though, distinguish a particular vibrational signal or visual signal from this background? And that's the key, right? I mean,
it's like a sine
wave. How do you locate your keys in a house, in your house that's full of stuff? It's like, well, I know what they're supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm. Right. You freaking matrix in.
Yeah.
What that, ouch. Which is like, oh, Jesus. So, and I love what you said. So we were relying on our eyes, period.
Yeah.
I would, let me pose you the question, Bob. Would you rather be deaf or blind?
I think I'll take deaf over blind.
Me too. As a
muskie. What about a muskie?
He would rather be blind than deaf.
Yep.
Because there will never be a study. They can't do it where we remove the lateral line. They can't do
it. Oh, they did it.
Did they really?
Study. Yeah, they did it.
Oh, crap. How?
They did it. They were, that study that I was talking about. They surgically blinded them. Like
split the nerve or something?
Some of them. Yep. And they did the same thing to the lateral line on different fish.
How'd they fare?
The ones that had no lateral line had trouble. It was.
Yeah.
Well, trouble. I mean, the ones that were. Let's just say they had their eyes, but they didn't have their lateral line. Their efficiency for capturing prey from a strike went down a little bit. Not a lot, but it went down. So they can use their eyes to close the deal.
Right.
But that's, they don't. Creepy. Well, the other thing they did, this, you should read this study. I should send you the link.
Oh, yeah. Horrific.
They also did stuff like, I'm going to blind one eye and then I'm gonna snip the lateral line on one side.
Was this conducted by Heinrich Himmler? I mean,
pretty close. But these were muskies that came from like a private hatchery.
Right. These are not.
So they're juveniles. They didn't like go out and capture them or anything. But on hook and line or something silly like that to do this terrible stuff. But very interesting, though.
Where the hierarchy of input, and like you said, it's noise where you go, you know, close your eyes and you can triangulate where certain things are.
Yeah.
You know, here's this sound, here's that. But visually you go, that's how, I mean, as humans, we're far more reliant on sight.
Yes.
But I...
Well, yeah, it's like if somebody snaps their fingers behind you,
mm-hmm.
you can tell, your ears will tell you what direction the snap was from. But can you tell me within 5 feet how far away it was?
Yeah.
Range is terrible for us.
Oh,
with, but distance, you know, or direction is, we're pretty good at.
I mean, that's the thing. We're binaural. You know, most of us, I mean, I'm like freaking 60% on my left ear, which is like everything's kind of off for me,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
is too many years in headphones where you think about that and you go.
I mean, mine was too many Metallica concerts.
Absolutely.
Just a little bit too close to the big amp.
but for me, it's like, you know, I deafen myself intentionally enough to not hear my wife. Hey, Steven, what? Huh? What?
Exactly.
I've been faking all this time, folks. I can hear perfectly. But you know, exactly. Too many Metallica concerts, you blow them out. But you mm-hmm. can, like for me, where my left ear is weaker than my right ear, it skews your perspective, like you said, of sound. Where you go, whoa. And so that perspective being at the end of the day, where I come back to is the computational power of what can you matrix where. You know, I'm looking right now. Here's a Titan laying there. I can see every grid line on it. I can see the color. I can see the eyes. I can see the right. blah, 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 blah. I don't believe Mr. Peanut Brain Muskie can really see detail. I mean, right. that would be an extreme in the animal kingdom. The amount of computational power of his brain would be an absolute outlier, I believe.
Yeah, I would guess that they can probably hear the difference.
Yes.
They can hear the difference. Their lateral line, it wouldn't surprise me at all if we found out that, you know, the percentage of their brain dedicated to processing lateral line input
right.
is big, a oh, large yeah. fraction. But those organs are huge,
yeah.
right? I mean, that lateral line organ is monstrous. It's like their
whole, in comparison to their side. Eyes, yeah.
right. So...
Much like my organ, it's huge, freaking huge, folks. Sorry, Dr. Bob just quit the podcast. Guys, this whole line, this is a theorem. This is up to interpretation. If you have an input, let us know. There's so much yet to learn about these fish. And I think it's so much fun when we trade an email. We're theorizing. It might be wrong, might be right. What do you think? What I think? What do you think on the topic? You know, what have you seen? The conversation narrows when we change water clarity entirely. You know, how do they predate in chocolate milk where it permeates the water column? You know, I like I said, I think we'd be remiss to say we're preaching the gospel and this is steadfast truth. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree with that. I'm a physicist, not a fisheries biologist, but I know a little bit about the way that these sensory organs work and a little bit about how they interact with their environment, at least just enough to be dangerous, I would say.
Well, but I would sort of wrap things up and saying fishing for muskies is like playing chess with the pigeon, right? The pigeon just stretch around the board, shits on it, and pretends he won.
I got a question for you, though. Which yes. one's, is the muskie the pigeon, or is that us?
Both of us, buddy.
Exactly.
Thank you, Dr. Bob.
All right, appreciate it, Steve.
Jay, was that not crazy with Dr. Bob? Holy cannoli.
Wow, I think I'm going to have to listen to that a couple times. Wow.
We're nerding now. It's one of those things, like, once we sort of hit that, and that's in real time. I don't plan anything on the podcast. We started talking about, like, the conical shape of baits and the way they transmit the vibration.
Yeah.
You know, the way they come through water is undeniable. It sort of hurt my head where a bucktail's going to be this 360 freaking cone where glide baits are left to right, and there's a void up and down, and a crankbait is this, and
ouch, me brain hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's physics, baby. What are you gonna do? You know, why does a bucktail work so often or in the crappiest conditions? Well, you happen to land a bite. It is a brain bender of a podcast. You know, we'll delve into it more down the road. It just, oh goodness, it hurt my brain.
No.
But anyway, Jay, do you have another afternoon delight coming up?
Well, I do. Sure. Yeah.
Well, he's working on it, folks. Anyway, Jay Bird, say good night.
Thank you, guys. Good night.
Later. Stay tuned. Bye-bye, Jay's Baby Week.